Hello, welcome to Irish Imperial Lives. I'm Kate O'Malley.
And I'm A.B. Philbin-Bowman. Today we're talking about a man who is a study in contradictions. He's born into a humble Catholic family in Tipperary. As a baby, he is held aloft by Daniel O'Connell. As a young boy, he witnesses a famine eviction and never forgets it.
Yet he enlists in the British Army, where he serves with incredible distinction from Burma in the east to the western wilderness of Canada to the malarial battlefields of West Africa.
He helps to suppress the Fenian invasion of Canada. He's appointed aide-de-camp to Queen Victoria. Yet he goes grouse shooting with Charles Stewart Parnell and openly declares his support for Home Rule.
In the 1870s, he proposes that maybe Canada should have a mounted police force. And a couple of years later, the Mounties are founded.
He's married to the greatest military painter of the Victorian age, and she continues to paint incredible works long into their marriage.
And he himself is a writer whose books, based on his military exploits, are bestsellers.
He's an outspoken critic of British military bureaucracy and indeed Western civilization. He almost averts the Boer War.
Our guest today is Chris Green, host of the History Chap podcast and YouTube channel, which focuses on British military history.
And we began by asking Chris how William Butler's early experiences of the famine shaped his outlook in later life.
In his autobiography, he talks about going down the lanes in County Tipperary and there just being hordes of people. And then suddenly there was almost nothing. And the other thing that really struck with him was seeing a family evicted by a landlord who, quite frankly, didn't care. They couldn't pay their rent and they were out. And I think that those two things, but in particular the second one, stayed with him for all of his life and certainly influenced the way that he viewed not least the British Empire and Western civilization in inverted commas.
He has a memory of visiting Richmond Prison and that he was held up in Daniel O'Connell's arms, who shouted, "Hurrah for Tipperary."
I suspect that's the 1840s equivalent of baby kissing, you know, for on the election trail. I'm sure O'Connell did that with a number of babies. Hurrah for insert county name here. It's interesting for somebody who does join the British Army. He joins in 1858, just after the Indian Mutiny.
He starts at the very bottom, really, Chris, doesn't he?
Yeah, he joined the army in 1858 in the 69th Regiment of Foot. And he joined at the lowest officer level, which is called an ensign.
Yeah.
And in fairness, that's where most officers came in at. This was still in an era where you purchased your commissions. So rather than being recruited by ability, it was all about could you cough up the money?
Of course.
And that became a big issue for Sir William Butler, because whilst he came from the gentry in Ireland, he was very much at the bottom of the gentry.
What's so interesting about it, though, is that is starting to change a bit. And one of the driving forces of that change is a man he meets early on in his career. Can you tell us a bit about Garnet Wolsey and how the two men first meet?
Yeah, of course, a Dublin man, Garnet Wolsey. He was about 5 years older than William Butler. And he too, actually, interestingly, struggled to get into the army because he couldn't afford to get a place. Eventually, he actually wrote to the Duke of Wellington at the time, who was commander-in-chief of the British Army.
A Meath man, of course, as we've discussed earlier in the series.
Here we go again, another Irishman. And he played on that, actually. He definitely played on, we share a common heritage here. But so Butler and Wolseley met on Butler's first foreign assignment in Burma, or Myanmar, as it's now called, the Second Anglo-Burmese War. It was actually one where Garnet Wolsey himself was injured, wounded in battle, and they sort of got to know each other and they struck a bond. He would call in that favour in 1870, when Wolsey was given command of the Red River Expedition in Canada, which would sort of be the making of William Butler as well.
His early career is based on pestering him with telegrams, I think you could say, Chris. Is that true?
Yes, Wolsey created around himself what was called the Wolseley Ring, or sometimes called the Ashanti Ring of officers, who were basically talented officers. This was his own doing. It wasn't something the British Army encouraged. He almost created his own general staff of people he would bring in on different campaigns because he rated them. And that was the first time that anyone had really done that. Wolsey was a great reformer in the British Army. He also had an incredible ego. He believed he was probably the best general in the British Army at the time. Gilbert and Sullivan famously parodied him in the modern Major General song, was written about Garnet Wolseley
in
their operetta. And supposedly Wolseley actually was so impressed, he used to sing it around the house. So we're talking a man who definitely believed he was Britain's greatest general at the time.
He believed he was the very model of a modern major general. My goodness. Anyway, one of his next missions, he's sent to Canada. I think he has a role in suppressing the Fenian uprising. Am I right about that?
Yeah, the Fenian invasions of Canada are an interesting story in their own right. The big invasion was in 1867. There was the Battle of Ridgeway, but eventually the Fenians were defeated by Canadian forces rather than British redcoats. Butler had been brought across in about 1867, or his regiment had been brought across, really to bolster the border because people like O'Neill were still at large in the USA. His unit fought General John O'Neill at the Battle of Trout River, or so-called Battle of Trout River. And I say that only because the massive losses in this huge battle at Trout River was one Fenian dead, one wounded, and one British soldier wounded, which is not quite D-Day, 1944, is it?
There's a second Canadian chapter, and it's really the richest. Yeah. Remarkably, he goes back to Ireland. I think his father may be dying at this period. But he hears of more action in Canada. He hears about this Red River expedition. And he really wants to get involved. He petitions various parts of the British government and the army, and nobody will send him. And he writes this incredible description in his book, The Great Lone Land, of literally jumping in a cab, going across town to the Cunard Line. There are two boats on offer to North America leaving that week. And he says, hang on, isn't the second one that broke down for 3 months? And they go, yes, sir, it is. Well, put me on that one because I'm sure they've been over it. I'm sure it won't break down twice in two voyages. So he travels across to America, writes incredible descriptions of New York, Chicago, which is only 30 years old, makes his way up to the camp in Canada. And again, he describes arriving at the camp and all the other soldiers like, no, we're leaving tomorrow, mate. The places are all taken. He says, they're like the guys who, when you arrive late for dinner, go, oh, you missed the soup. It was delicious. I'm so sorry you're here late. But I want to come to this point, which I think myself and Kate are going to read together. This is his pitch to Wolseley when he finally meets Garnet Wolseley.
At last I met the commander himself.
My good fellow, there's not a vacant berth for you,
he said.
I got your telegram, but the whole army in Canada wanted to go on the expedition.
I think, sir, there is one berth still vacant, I answered.
What is it?
You will want to know what they are doing in Minnesota and along the flank of your march, and you will have no one to tell you, I said.
You are right. We do want a man out there. Look now, start from Montreal by first train tomorrow. By tonight's mail, I will write to the general recommending your appointment. If you see him as soon as possible, it may yet be all right.
I thanked him, and in little more than 24 hours found myself in Montreal, the commercial capital of Canada.
I mean, the chutzpah, Chris, to like travel at his own expense halfway around the world, get to the camp, have everyone telling him there's no job for you, there's no job for you. And he turns around and goes, I think you're going to want somebody along the Minnesota border just in case of any Fenian raids, anything like that. And they suddenly go, we hadn't even thought of that.
It's brilliant. And of course, just before he left Britain, he actually cabled Wolseley. And you only had five words on a telegram. So his five-word message to Wolseley, he says, Winnipeg Expedition, please remember me.
Oh, wow. So that's literally five words.
Why spend an extra penny if you could possibly help it?
One of the interesting things about William Butler, I think, is that he has a great sympathy very often for the people he's fighting against. He first of all says, look, the rebellion was well organised, well set up. And he actually, again, starts with this very sympathetic passage going, think about these people. These are people who 50, 60, 70 years earlier had gone as settlers into the vast Canadian wilderness. They had fended for themselves. He's like, they're out in the wilderness. They're battling the elements. They're battling bears. They're battling the indigenous people. Of course they are rough and ready people. And to be suddenly told that the Hudson Bay Company has done a deal with Her Majesty's government or the province of Canada, and now you belong to these people, of course they're going to kick off against that. And he then points out that Riel has gone too far, become a bit of a despot and so on.
Didn't he meet Riel?
He did. He then sets off on this expedition via Canada through America, and he's reading all these newspaper reports. There's going to be Fenians rising or other supports, because the American press is quite hostile to the British Empire at this point.
Very much so. Because, of course, the Americans had always been quite ambivalent with regards to Canada. There were people in America who saw it as unfinished business from the War of Independence. But they certainly saw, if the British were in Ontario and Quebec and the Maritime provinces on the east, they saw a huge opportunity for America to expand in what's now Western Canada.
He actually beats the expedition to get to Fort Garry, where this guy Louis Riel is holed up. And he's on a steamship getting there, and he realises, as they're heading towards Fort Garry, that Riel and his men are going to be waiting for him. So he finds one guy on board, and the two of them plan to jump out shortly before they land onto a small sandbank that they know the boat has to pass by. So in darkness, at a dead of night, he packs his revolver, he packs his rifle, and he brings his dog. And this guy jumps, Butler follows after him with the dog, and then scurries up the embankment, sees Fort Garry, heads in the opposite direction. Your man is dropped off at Winnipeg in his house, from where he promises to send a horse. Butler then is walking his way through, trying to avoid being noticed, being seen. And he comes to the bridge where he's meant to wait for the horse, and he sees there's a sentry on the bridge. So he can't stop, he can't look indecisive. He actually lets his dog go, hoping to recapture it. The dog is never seen again. And he just crosses the bridge with purpose and thinks, well, if I wait here, I'm bunched. Your man's going to get suspicious. I've just got to keep on going. He walks all the way through the woods at night and eventually comes to a town and seeks help there. But in the story, he goes, but now let's return to my pursuers. He's such a great writer. So he describes the pursuers, and they've been told about this enormous man of great proportions with this enormous dog. Here's how he writes. People shuddered as they listened to this part of the story. A dog of gigantic size? What a picture, this immense man, that immense dog, stalking through the gloom-wrapped prairie. Was it to be wondered at that the pursuit, vigorously though it commenced, should have waned faint as it reached the dusky prairie? The party, previous to daybreak, halted at a house known by the suggestive title of Whiskey Tom's. Whether it ever got further on its way remains a mystery, but I'm inclined to think that the many attractions of Mr. Tom's residence, as evinced by the prefix to his name, must have proved a powerful obstacle to such thirsty souls. In other words, they stopped for a jar. They didn't really want to meet this enormous guy with a massive dog, who, by the way, was me, and I wasn't that fearsome. But I think they stopped for whiskey and they probably didn't get any further. The dryness of the writing is really fantastic.
I'm glad the dog got away, Aby.
But he anyway escapes, and he then meets Riel, and he says, look, here he is. He's trying to impress me how great he is, but he's dressed as a priest and he's wearing Native American moccasins. And on the feet of a Native American, they look fine. But on this guy, they just look ridiculous. And that this means he can then go and find Wolsey and give him the intel on, I know exactly who you're up against. I've met the man, I've talked to him, I've got the measure of him. And I think Riel actually flees.
And the expedition itself was extraordinary because, of course, it covered hundreds of miles of uncharted Canada. No one had done the journey that Wolseley did. And so Louis Riel and his men thought, there's no way a British army is going to make their way through the wilderness without coming a real cropper. And this is down to Wolseley's military organisation. Of course, he got all his men through without losing a single man in any of the rapids or anything that they had to come through. That totally shocked Riel and, in particular, most of his supporters. And so they all deserted him, and he was sort of left with, you know, one man and a dog defending Fort Garry, and then he did a runner to America.
I mean, he's also very funny in his description of travelling through North America and Minnesota. He stops in Duluth at one point. I cannot say I enjoyed a stay of 2 days in Duluth. Several new saloons, named for dram shops, gaming houses and generally questionable places, were being opened for the first time to the public, and free drinks were consequently the rule. Now, free drinks have generally a demoralising tendency upon a community, but taken in connection with a temperature of 98 degrees in the shade, they quickly develop into free revolvers and freer Bowie knives. I mean, he gets wonderfully dry.
I have to say, you know, I mean, it's an old book now, you know, published in the 1870s, but The Great Loneland is an incredible travel book.
It really is.
And it went through 17 publications.
Mm. Wow.
Rather like you, Aby, I've loved reading it and his other books.
He kind of doubles up, really, Chris, as a travel writer in today's terms. He went on these huge treks and he was commissioned to report on various circumstances at borders. And one in particular was like a 2,700-mile trek from Quebec to the Rockies and back. Yeah. In the wake of one of these, he had suggested the establishment of the Northwest Mounted Police. Could you tell us a bit about that?
His third book, because he wrote three books about Canada, The Great Lonely Land, which was sort of his military journey on this expedition that we've been talking about. Then The Great Northland, which was this other report that he did, or another journey that he did. And from there, of course, you're absolutely right, he recommended there should be a mobile police force, which became the Northwest Mounted Police.
Can we move on now, Chris, and look at the other side of the Atlantic? Because in 1873, he joined Wolseley in his expedition against the Ashanti in West Africa, which is Ghana today. Tell us a little bit about that. He got another book out of it, we should say, called Akin Fu, The History of Failure.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, so by this stage, Wolseley had done his job and he'd been recalled back to Britain. And now there was a falling out between the British on the coast of what's modern day Ghana and the Kingdom of the Ashanti, or the Ashanti Empire, which is based around the town of Kumasi in central Ghana. And this was not the first time the British and the Ashanti had traded blows. I think this is the third time. In fact, actually the first time in the 1820s, the Ashanti had come off very well. The British governor had been defeated. In fact, his head was taken to their capital and made into a ceremonial drinking cup. So the Ashanti were no pushovers as well. Most of them were armed with rifles as well, muskets. They were a feared force in West Africa. So anyway, there was yet another falling out between the British and the Ashanti. This would go through impenetrable jungle to get to the Ashanti capital. So who better would you have than a man that went through the impenetrable wilderness of Canada? So Wolseley's star was on the rise and was rising even further. And meanwhile, of course, William Butler was still over in Canada, you know, doing all his 1,000-mile journeys. So once again, he was on the wrong side of the Atlantic for an adventure with Garnet Wolseley. So again, he sends a telegram and Wolseley said, yeah, get over here ASAP.
Which ASAP by those days is probably not what we'd imagine.
Well, no, it's probably about, you know, in a month's time when your ship gets into Liverpool or whatever it was. And sure enough, by the time Butler gets to England, Wolseley's already down on the west coast of Africa. Butler grabs the first ship he can that can take him to West Africa, and he arrives, despite that head start that Wolseley had, he arrives just under 2 weeks behind. And there he's given the role of recruiting some local tribes who live on the coast under British protection to assist the British army going up against the Ashanti, which he does. However, as you've alluded to with the book, they basically ran at the first sign of trouble. And that's part of Butler's story of a failure. Absolutely. In the sense he wasn't able to raise an African army that could actually hold its own against the Ashanti.
It was also a disease-ridden campaign, right?
Oh, massively so. Things like malaria at this stage, of course, there was no cure for it. He went down, he was invalided back to Britain.
And when he was in hospital, did he meet Queen Victoria during his convalescence?
You're absolutely right, Kate. He was sent back to Britain to a hospital called Netley Hospital, just in between Portsmouth and Southampton, built by Florence Nightingale during the Crimean War as a state-of-the-art hospital. It was huge, this massive Victorian building facing out onto the sea where they could open all the windows and let sea air come in. It was just across the water from the Isle of Wight, where Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert, had built Osborne House. So she used to pop over and see soldiers on a regular basis.
He must have made a good impression, because he is later appointed aide-de-camp to Queen Victoria briefly. But extraordinarily, I think, for somebody who's so senior in the British military, he's also an out-and-out supporter of Home Rule.
And he's a Catholic.
And he's a friend of Charles Stewart Parnell. Oh. I think they go grouse shooting together. Yeah. So can you talk to us a little bit about how the British establishment would have responded to this very decorated soldier, clearly very brave, because done amazing things for the empire, and yet
huge.
Writes openly, I support Home Rule. How does that work?
Maybe one of his memoirs, Lord Milner, down in South Africa later on, probably penned it best. He described Butler as that brilliant but impossible Irishman. He was always seen as a thinking soldier. Without dishing the British Army too much at that time, thinking soldiers were always regarded with a bit of suspicion. As an Irishman, I mean, there were plenty of Irishmen in the British Army at the time, so that in itself wasn't an issue. To a large extent, you know, the British Empire, if it hadn't been for Scottish and Irish officers, probably would never have got built. Certainly wasn't down to the English ones. He was described as someone who had Irish temperament.
I think
what they were basically saying was, it's almost like, oh, here we go again, it's him. We asked him to write a report, and he did write a report, actually, in the 1890s. It was so damning of the British Army that the report was actually just burnt.
So he wasn't afraid to be critical of the army.
Absolutely not. You know, and he went on, and again, he wrote a highly critical report during the Anglo-Boer War as well.
There's two really interesting points you raise. One is this idea of being a thinking soldier, because he writes in his autobiography later that he was really struck by how few thinking soldiers he met in his career. And there's a quote that's attributed to him, and I think this is a fabulous insight. The nation that will insist upon drawing a broad line of demarcation between the fighting man and the thinking man is liable to find its fighting done by fools and its thinking done by cowards. And I just think that is a fantastic defense of why you need a thinking soldier. You do not want your fighting done by fools, nor do you want your thinking done by cowards. The point you make about military bureaucracy, it also speaks to a later mission he's sent on. Garnet Wolseley again recruits him when he's going to rescue General Gordon. Essentially, the Royal Navy says, to build the boats to do this mission, to get from England all the way to Sudan, it's going to take 3 months. And he brings Butler in, and Butler says, I can probably do it in a month. But he lays out so clearly in his writings exactly what's required. It's now the 5th of August. Not a boat yet ordered, not a design made. 3 months less 5 days in which to design, order, build, embark, land in Egypt, move by rail, embark in steamers, carry 400 miles, launch, move by water, drag up the first cataract, tow to Wadi Halfa, move to the top of the second cataract, and finally disquipped 1,000 miles from the Mediterranean, these 400 English boats. Can it be done? Yes, on one condition, that we clear all of the detritus out of the way of the great city known as departmental administration. He's basically saying, clear out of the way, bureaucrats. If you give me the money, I can get it done, but get out of my way and let me do what I have to do. And off he sets.
And how many times has that been repeated? We've got to find a new way of doing this. We cannot do the same old, you know, committees ordering this and committees ordering that. And the British Army was notorious for that at the time.
But we have to talk about his role in South Africa and in almost averting the Boer War. Remind us of the sort of the situation he was entering into and what job he was sent to do.
So in South Africa, in that time, there were two white communities, the British in what was called the Cape and Natal, and then you had two Boer republics, the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. Boers were descendants principally from Dutch farmers who'd originally settled in South Africa. Fundamentally, the British had always had their eyes on these two republics, principally because they wanted to create something rather like Canada, actually, a big dominion that could sort of look after itself but be a British interest in South Africa. But then, of course, it got worse because in South Africa, gold was found in Johannesburg, in the South African Republic, Transvaal. And suddenly, you know, there were a lot more reasons why you might want those two republics than when they were just farming communities. Loads of miners were coming to South Africa to seek their fortunes. They're called Eightlanders. And the Boers were fearful that the Eightlanders would outnumber them. And if they allowed them all to have a vote, they would actually effectively lose their own homeland to Eightlanders, most of whom happened to be of British stock. And so President Kruger of the South African Republic, he could see that he was about to lose his own country. So there's a huge amount of animosity, not helped by a lot of British imperialists who were very keen to use those Eightlanders as a cause to invade Transvaal.
They want to create agitation and they want to ramp up tensions.
Great excuse. And one of the key imperialists in that, of course, was Cecil Rhodes, who had actually used his own private police force to invade Transvaal 3 years before Butler turns up in South Africa. It was a failed thing. It was called the Jameson Raid. For the Boers, this is like, well, how overt can the British be? I mean, they might hide behind this as a private citizen with his own private police force. But Cecil Rhodes at the time did happen to be the Prime Minister of the British Cape Colony as well. So, you know, you can hardly say he was just some wacko from the British community. He was in league with the very British government and others, or certainly that's how Kruger and people saw them. And you could understand why.
And Butler comes into this, I think, as head of the army. And he, when he arrives, realises, actually, we don't even have enough troops to defend our own land. And if we were to kick something off with the Boers, as I'm being pushed to do by Cecil Rhodes and others, then potentially we could lose this thing. That respect he always had for the underdog, that respect for the Canadian rebels, etc. He has very much that same respect for the Boers. He recognises, I think accurately, that they are well-entrenched, good fighters, know the territory and very determined to hold on to what they have.
And I think what you say there is really important, AB. He respected them as opposed to supported them, because that's what was depicted back in Britain. Isn't that right, Chris?
Oh, yeah. He'd actually been in one of the Boer republics in the 1870s. So Wolseley had brought him down. Wolseley had been a commander in Southern Africa for a period. And he was sent to the Orange Free State to really see, basically, if they could somehow join the British Empire, what the feeling was. And he came away with a huge respect for the Boers. But that respect, as you said, Kate, was seen as, it was depicted certainly in some South African papers and certainly in Britain, as he was pro-Boer.
When he was, in fact, just a pragmatist, really.
Absolute pragmatist. He basically said, look, if we put the limited amount of troops we've got, by the way, we don't have enough to actually take on the Boers if they mobilise. If we go and put them on the border, like Lord Milner was saying, the High Commissioner in South Africa, the number one British political person, if you go and have a fight with these guys, you're biting off more than you can chew. If they do mobilise and come across the border, our men will be isolated. They will be besieged.
Okay.
And we don't have enough men to actually fight them in the first place. Better to have them held way back towards the coast. If the Boers decide to be provocative, if the Boers decide to invade our colonies, then we can send them to the appropriate places. And of course, again, Milner was sort of agitating against him back in London. He jumped before he was pushed.
Yes.
But in early 1899, William Butler resigns as commander-in-chief in South Africa.
So he resigns, the Boer War happens. And can you outline the cost of that war?
Yeah, certainly. So he resigned in early 1899. By October, the British imperialists had got their war. And that was a war that, strangely enough, went exactly the way that Butler said. They had their troops up on the border. The Boers came across the border, besieged them in three different locations. Hundreds of thousands of men had to be sent down to South Africa. The British lost something like 22,000 killed, 75,000 wounded.
I'm choosing here because I have your figures from your own work in front of me. But I mean, you estimate something like 500,000 men to defeat a Boer army less than a fifth of that size.
Yeah.
The total cost was £200 million, which is about 20 billion in today's money. And as you say, 20,000 British soldiers, 14,000 Boer soldiers, 26,000 Boer civilians and 20,000 black Africans.
And of course, controversially, the British also set up what were called concentration camps, where they moved the Boer civilian populations into these camps so they couldn't supply the guerrilla forces. So the Boers became guerrilla fighters, put them in these camps, didn't really think about how those camps were going to be run. Typhoid and other things ran rife through those camps, and something like 26,000 Boer civilians, mainly women, elderly, children, died.
And of course, we should be clear that the concentration camps, the idea was that you were just concentrating the population in one place so you could guard them. But of course, that idea was then taken to a completely different level by the extermination camps in Nazi Germany. There's no direct comparison. We should just be clear.
We should say that. The concentration camps were to concentrate the population so they couldn't supply the Boer guerrilla fighters, not to eliminate or liquidate Boer civilians. Unfortunately, because they chucked them in the camps and didn't do sanitation and stuff, so many Boers died. And of course, you know, that's a huge angst in the Afrikaner community, to this day. It wasn't a deliberate British policy. I think you could definitely say it was a negligent British policy.
Certainly. It's another example, I think, of the British Empire taking actions which the local population remembers a lot longer than the British perhaps remember, and it shapes those feelings to this day.
Yeah. But
also, when you look back at it, Chris, absolutely. And you think about that discovery of gold, you know, what would have happened otherwise? Because Butler later wrote of his regret that, quote, the majority of our recent wars should have had their origins in purely financial interests or sordid stock exchange ambitions. So you also, again, at the very end of his career, somebody who's fully aware of the impact that imperialism writ large is having on local communities.
Yeah, and whilst he was obviously speaking as an Irishman and a British Army officer, that was sort of what was happening across the world as well, of course, at that time. You know, the Germans and the French and the Portuguese, there were plenty of other people
in
this imperial game.
Oh, of course, and we cover that in the series, exactly, yeah.
But what was interesting was there you had a man who was identifying what the problem was.
Yes.
And starting to say, you know, as Kipling called it, the white man's burden. Actually, you know, how much do we need to be there? And as I go all the way back to his North American writings, where he really laments the passing of an era.
Big thanks to our guest today. That was Chris Green, a.k.a. The History Chap. You'll find his podcast, his YouTube channel, The History Chap. And he's done some fantastic work, particularly if you're interested in British military history. Also, thanks to everyone who gets our show on the air. That's Jack Murphy, Elizabeth Larrigy, Nigel Wheatley, Sally Curran. And our theme music is from composer Bill Whelan's Belfast, Linen and Lace. And if you enjoyed that episode half as much as me, please join me in thanking our listener, Mark Clinton, who got in touch to recommend we do an episode on Sir William Butler. If you've got a suggestion you'd like to send our way, irishimperiallives@rte.ie.
If you want to listen back to all of our episodes, you can find them on the RTE website or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Irish Imperial Lives.